Monster Man, special episode, GIF.
Hello and welcome to Monster Man, a show about monsters because monsters are great. I'm James Holloway, and I'm reading my way through the gaming books of yesteryear. And as I do, I'm talking about the monsters that I find in them. Their history, their mythology, their ecology, their imagery, and how to use them in games.
Today's episode is a special episode, brought to you by the generosity of my Patreon backers, and in particular, of Patreon backer Tim. Tim has asked me to talk about the GIF. That's G-I-F-F, GIF, not G-I-T-H, GITH. I know that can be tricky over a recording. These are the imperialist hippo mercenary guys from Spelljammer, not the weird mystic rivals from the Fiendfolio. If you'd like to be like Tim and get your own special episode, all you gotta do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. And if you do that, in addition to your own special episode, you'll also get access to my other main podcast, Patron Deities, in which I go through the Deities and Demigods supplement for Advanced Dungeons & Dragons and take a look at the gods, heroes, and mythological beings that are in it, and how to use them and religion and mythology more generally in your fantasy role-playing games. So Tim, thank you very much, and I hope that you enjoyed today's episode. Now, unlike an episode where I'm describing, like, the Sphinx or even the Beholder, I think we should probably start with a description of the GIF in a little more detail, because they're not something that we've come across previously. GIF originate, I think, in the Spelljammer setting. And Spelljammer, if you're not familiar with it, was a space-traveling, although not necessarily science-fictional, D&D setting. So one in which magically-powered ships were traveling between the various spheres of the D&D cosmos. In it, one might run across GIF, who were these kind of mercenaries. They're big, hippo-like humanoids, and their entire culture was focused around this idea of being mercenaries. GIF society, rather than having, you know, towns or villages or whatever, is organized into platoons. And platoons can be of varying sizes. Rather confusingly, it's not remotely the size of a platoon. So in kind of military English, a platoon is the organizational unit between a company and a squad. So a platoon is about, like, 20-ish people. You know, it varies from time to time and place to place, but it's sort of roughly about that size, whereas a GIF platoon could be two people or it could be dozens. So GIF are very militaristic. They are enamored of all forms of warfare. They love fighting, and it's really just like the central thing of their culture. But culturally, they're not sort of barbaric warriors. I mean, I think that is the big thing that makes the GIF stand out from other kind of militarized cultures, is that they are civilized soldiers, not barbaric warriors. Although, as I think we shall see, there are other examples of this elsewhere in D&D. Their role in Spelljammer, I think aesthetically, was to be one of the settings you're not in Kansas anymore monsters. Most variant fantasy settings will have some kind of distinctive monsters, the goal of which is to distinguish the setting from others. So Spelljammer is a whimsical D&D setting with kind of a higher degree of modernism than traditional D&D, and so therefore, it's got a whimsical, modernist monster to be kind of one of its flagship monsters, I guess, in the same way that the space hamster, you know, again gives you some of that Spelljammer whimsy. I should say they're also technological, so civilized, technological, whimsical monster, because GIF use guns. There are guns in Spelljammer, and guns really seem to be the default thing that separates the medieval from the modern for a lot of D&D players, which is interesting because there are guns in periods that I would absolutely think of as the Middle Ages. I mean, not like muskets like the GIF have, but definitely, to me, gunpowder weapons feel more medieval than, say, the printing press. But many D&D settings assume relatively widespread literacy and the existence of, you know, easily available books and things like newspapers and wanted posters and so on, which are all products of technology that I would typically think of as post-medieval. Obviously, there's not a big switch that flips and people go, oh, it's the early modern period now. Like, that's not how historical periodization works, but people are very willing to insert analogs for things like the printing press, Protestantism or America into their medieval settings in a way that they're not so much with guns, which I think is fascinating. And the GIF are hard to discuss because so much of their portrayal is aesthetic. Like, I don't think that the GIF originally became quite the phenomenon that they later would be, and I think it's very much down to the art and to the way in which portrayals of the GIF kind of give them this. I would describe the GIF as charming, and I think it's their big hippo faces. Hippos are dangerous animals, but they're kind of, they're nice looking. You look at a hippo's face, and maybe it's the way that the shape of its mouth kind of makes it look like it's smiling a small, slightly self-satisfied smile, but something of that carries over into the GIF and makes them seem approachable. The transgressive nature of the GIF is a little tricky to implement in a mainstream non-Spelljammer D&D game, because there's essentially two ways to approach it. The first is to have the GIF just be kind of a default part of the setting, and the second is to have the GIF fulfill that role of alienness. So when someone comes in from another plane and they're accompanied by GIF bodyguards, or you travel to some distant sphere and there are a bunch of GIFs. But as D&D has moved further and further away from its roots in medievalism, so the GIF have become less and less exotic in terms of at least their sort of surface appearance. In general, I mean, this is something that we've talked about before, but Dungeons & Dragons was created by people who were lovers of medieval history. And for a long time, even before that, the medieval and the fantastic have been closely associated. Every year, well, not this past year because my class didn't happen, but every year in a history class that I teach, I ask my students to write an analysis of a film set in a historical period, typically the ancient or medieval periods, because that's where we're up to by the time of the year that I assign this essay. And every year I get at least one student ask me if they can write about a film that is obviously a fantasy film. Or one year I had a student ask me if they could write about Game of Thrones. And I'm like, I don't think dragons and zombies were real. I don't think it's that people think that dragons and zombies were real. It's more that they think a little bit like the Middle Ages were not real. But that's another point. Mine is simply that for a long time, there was an association between medievalism and fantasy. And that has changed. I think at least partly due to the influence of fantasy from other parts of the world which are not as rooted in a romantic fascination with medieval Europe. And I think that that emphasis on the Middle Ages as like the appropriate cultural setting for fantasy has decreased and is maybe more a thing of kind of older generations now. You know, I see a lot of people out there whose D&D games are set in a more early modern kind of analog. Think about the trend toward modernism in fantasy fiction, where you get things like the most recent Joe Abercrombie novels are set in a world that's undergoing an industrial revolution, or things like Perdido Street Station, right, where it's a fantasy novel, but it's not medieval. It's set in a place that has kind of the feel of like Gilded Age New York. Or, I mean, there are lots of examples, right? I think that, broadly speaking, we're seeing a wider range of influences becoming acceptable in what people think of as fantasy, which is not a bad thing. I'm not complaining about that. Like, don't get me wrong. I know a lot of people observe this change and they grumble because it's not like it was when they were kids. And, of course, grognard means grumbler. But I'm just observing it. And it does raise a challenge for the GIF because the GIF are there to contrast with the player's expectations. And in a world of changing player expectations, they don't necessarily do that anymore. So what do you do with them? Tim talked about bringing them more into alignment with the kind of medieval aesthetic. And I think that if you switch that into the early modern period, actually you can do quite a lot. And I'll come to that in a moment. I've isolated a couple of things that I think you can focus on to make the GIF relevant in a game where their immediate aesthetic hit is no longer as important as it used to be. The first is to explore the idea of militarism. The GIF are not like most soldiers. I've never served in the military. I know that many of my listeners have, so maybe my assumptions are wrong and you can tell me otherwise. But my read on people's motivations for military service is that, I mean, obviously they're varied, right? Different people join the military for different reasons, but many of them do it because they feel a desire to serve their country or their community, or alternatively, they're looking for some form of career advancement, or they're doing it because they think that it will be fun, it'll be exciting, it'll be an adventure. And of course, in wartime, many people join up because they feel that there's some kind of an emergency, right? That, you know, that they're not maybe people who are militaristic the rest of the time, but they're committed to this particular cause, to, you know, defending us against the hated British or whatever, to defending the nation against the hated aggressor, or standing up for the rights of the people of other Placia, or what have you. But none of those really apply to the GIF, because the GIF are a militaristic culture without anything to fight for. They are mercenaries, but yet they don't seem to be devoted to money. They're devoted to military service. So they like being soldiers, and they're going to find some kind of reason to fight. You can't fight for no reason, but they also sort of don't care exactly what the reason is. They're devoted to the experience of being in the military, the structure, the hierarchy, the fancy uniforms. It does say that they love fighting, but it's not even so much that they love fighting, but that they love being soldiers. And that's very interesting. I do think that there are people like that, but I think it's very strange to find an entire culture so devoted to the idea of military service, but without any kind of apparent higher goal to it. You could do something with that. How did they get that way? What experience taught the GIF this was the best way to live? Were they made that way? It was hobgoblins that I was thinking of when I was thinking that there were other kind of militaristic D&D classic monsters. Orcs are warlike. Hobgoblins are militaristic. But typically, we find hobgoblins as minions. They are the shock troops of some evil bad guy, right? The hobgoblins are the fighting Uruk-hai, created or altered to turn the otherwise unpromising material of orcs into an army capable of taking on the realms of men. That's clearly not the case with the GIF, and also, they lack some of the other aspects of hobgoblins, so one can imagine that hobgoblins have, I mean, they're just kind of evil, right? They love, maybe not so much being soldiers, as they love war, because of the suffering that it inflicts, not just on the defeated, but on the innocent in general, right? They're burning rick, cot, and tree. They love the opportunity to hurt and despoil and terrorize that war brings, and I don't think that's what the GIF like. The GIF like a stand-up fight. You know, the GIF like to match their courage and skill at arms against an opponent. Secondly, you could explore the idea of their origins. I mean, did they once have a home? Did somebody make them like this? Where do they come from? Because I think that we can imagine, you know, historically there are analogs for nations that have a mercenary tradition, where their military culture, their military traditions have kind of overproduced or existed in response to a particular conflict that then ended, and those troops then like saw a lot of service outside their home. So you can think of Swiss mercenaries in the early modern period, for example, or you can think of, you know, English mercenaries in Italy, right? People like John Hawkwood, where the demand for soldiers created by the Hundred Years' War is intermittent. And so they wind up fighting in other people's wars because fighting is their trade. Or you can think of sort of 18th century Britain, where the 18th century British Army, this is where all those Hessian mercenaries in the American War of Independence come from. So maybe they come from some very warlike society, and then they sent off elements of their people to, you know, go out and be mercenaries, and then their homeworld was destroyed. It'd be interesting if they were kind of part of some larger effort to, you know, maybe the GIF mercenaries are just a cover, and GIF are spreading out across the galaxy, working as mercenaries to pay their way, but trying to find out what it was happened to their homeworld. So I mentioned the idea of giving the GIF a more medieval-ish aesthetic. That is something that Tim's question presupposes is desirable, and I'm not completely convinced of, but if you did, I think the answer to how you do it is easy, which is you make them Landsknechts. When I say Landsknechts, I'm talking about an aesthetic, rather than like a specific tactical organization. So Landsknechts are mercenary soldiers from, I guess, the 16th century, and maybe like the early 17th, I don't really know, they're not... I think of them as 30 Years' War guys, but actually I think they're around considerably before that, and maybe they're even gone by the 30 Years' War. But they are the sort of origin of that Warhammer look, right? The Warhammer Fantasy Empire look is kind of Germany of the 30 Years' War. So I'm talking big hats, I'm talking plumes, and those elaborately slashed and ruffled clothes with the big poofy sleeves and the slashed doublets and the lots of ribbons and things. This idea, you know, it's very interesting. The aesthetic of militarism changes all the time. So in today's like clothing and accessory market, tactical is basically a term that means matte black. But it wasn't always that way, right? Military uniforms don't start to become drably functional looking until first quarter of the 20th century, probably. You know, before that, concealment isn't really the goal. So it's all rippling flags and gold braid and bugle calls and what have you. And I think when you then, I mean, not to generalize, but when you then combine that with typically younger men who, as mercenaries, have been given access to, you know, maybe more money than they often have, in a highly fashion and status conscious society, what you get is outrageous outfits. But I like the idea of giant hippo lanceknechts, both on an aesthetic level, because it's a funny image, but also because the image of the lanceknecht brings up something that you don't generally see in a D&D monster, and indeed seldom in D&D player characters, because player characters tend to be sort of individualistic, which is a certain devil-may-care esprit de corps, right? You can imagine 7 or 8 GIF lanceknechts taking up all the space in a tavern with their feet up on the table, toasting their dead comrades with big quaffs of wine, and demanding that the piano player play martial songs for them to sing drunkenly along to. Like, this sort of dashing romantic view of these guys historically covers up a lot of the nastiness. And I think, you know, I think we attached a certain romantic view to these mercenaries because in an era where a lot of European warfare is religiously motivated and is often accompanied by kind of atrocities against civilians, maybe the figure of a mercenary is very appealing because the mercenary is just fighting for money, and that's a very understandable motivation as opposed to someone who's fighting because he's a Protestant and he hates Catholics or vice versa. That's not a fun, relatable motive. If you've seen, this is a complete tangent, if you've seen that film on Netflix, The King, it's a story about Henry V, and it ties itself in knots to suggest that the Battle of Agincourt was, you know, a heroic moment for Henry, but was not in any way his fault. He was tricked into the war by dishonest advisors, because it turns out that modern audiences are just not willing to accept that "I would quite like to be king of France" is a sympathetic motivation. Now, unlike most real-world mercenaries, and this, I guess, is, what are we on, number 4? So yeah, point 1, use them to talk about militarism. Point 2, explore the mystery of their origins. Point 3, I guess you can make them fancy-headed lanceknechts. Point 4, explore the idea specifically of mercenaries, because the thing about mercenaries is the GIF, unlike most mercenaries, are principled and reliable. It is interesting that mercenaries are often villains in modern media, and specifically we have this idea that mercenaries are less trustworthy and honest than regular soldiers. The modern perspective is the reverse of what I was talking about earlier, because we assume that, like, you know, a 17th century Swedish soldier is motivated by religious intolerance, whereas a 17th century mercenary is motivated by the love of gold, and we can kind of relate to the love of gold. But in modern media, we tend to view private military contractors as perfect villains, partly because of a post-2001 media landscape in which it became taboo to suggest that American militarism, at least, is, you know, bad and that violence is wrong. And so instead we have to distinguish between those who carry out violence for good reasons, like patriotism and a desire to serve the country, and those who carry it out for bad reasons, like money and self-interest. You know, even leaving aside the specific political environment of the first decade of the 21st century, it's easy to see how you would conclude that a person who is motivated strongly by patriotism or by ideology or by an ethos of community service can believe in general that it's wrong to shoot people, but that it is, you know, regrettably necessary to shoot people in this specific instance, whereas someone who signs up for, you know, Shoots Incorporated is interested in shooting people and doesn't really care that much about the context, which raises the question of whether they would shoot you or not. When you're dealing with Fantasy Blackwater, you never know whether the man with the sword is on your side or not. So another kind of mercenary analogy for the GIF might be something like the Varangian Guard, particularly if you keep them as really weird. You could do this in general, actually. A fantasy ruler might absolutely have a bodyguard of GIF or Kryons or whatever. Let me back up to talk about the Varangian Guard for a second in case you don't know about them. In the early Middle Ages and on into the High Middle Ages, the Byzantine Empire, I hate that word, but that's what a lot of people call them, the Roman Empire, but we call them the Byzantine Empire, employed a lot of mercenaries. They were a very wealthy state that often struggled to maintain the level of military manpower needed to defend their frontiers, and particularly to fight wars against neighboring powers. And many of those mercenaries came from sort of what is today Ukraine and Russia, and in many cases then originally came from Sweden. And these Varangians, as they were known, these Scandinavian or Scandinavian slash Russian soldiers, eventually wound up as a regiment of the Imperial Bodyguard. Now, the Imperial Bodyguard is not, they did do guard duties, they did do things like guard prisons and guard palaces, but also the Imperial Bodyguard was kind of the core standing military of the Byzantine Empire. During the early Middle Ages, it had this system of kind of military land allotments that created armies within each province, and then a central military reserve held in the capital, and that's the so-called Imperial Bodyguard, which is actually just kind of the main Imperial standing army. You know, for a bodyguard, it's thousands upon thousands of troops. And the Varangian Guard, these foreigners, were thought to be ideal bodyguards for the emperor because they were not themselves possible candidates for emperor. And they don't have any uncles in the capital. You know, when you have some kind of elite bodyguard unit surrounding the emperor, if they come from your own culture, this is going to be regarded as a plum post, and therefore it's going to be full of scions of noble families. That's the last thing you want, armed members of noble families close to the emperor. The Varangian Guard are, you know, battle-hardened military professionals loyal only to the person who signs their paychecks. Perhaps the most famous historical member of the Varangian Guard is, at that time, future king of Norway, Harald Hardrada, who fled Norway following the overthrow of his half-brother, St. Olaf, and after a few years wound up working as a mercenary in Byzantium, where he, you know, made the money that he needed to fund his reconquest of Norway, even though by the time he got back, his nephew Magnus had already taken over the country and thrown out the Danish regent. Anyway, my point is simply that the GIF's alien nature gives them a kind of outsider status that would make them excellent bodyguards for some kind of fantasy tyrant. You know, we need to get in there and overthrow Dark Lord Xurgathrax, but how do we get past his GIF mercenary guards with their outlandish high-tech weapons? Yeah, okay, I can see that. Finally, the mercenary nature of the GIF and their cute, fun hippo faces make them excellent sympathetic antagonists. There are a lot of different motivations for villains. You know, some are completely under the control of the main bad guy, you know, your zombies and your skeletons and your constructs. Some are, you know, motivated by actual malice. Some are just motivated by gold. But one of the things that I like about the GIF is their sense of professionalism. I like having people who are on the other side of a conflict, but are not otherwise bad. And the GIF would tend to view the battle against the player characters as kind of like the sheepdog and the wolf, you know, clocking in at the beginning of the day. They can fight the PCs without disliking them. Indeed, they may like and respect the PCs while trying to kill them, which I think is always fun in a villain. And they're not conflicted about it either. They might shed a kitschy little tear. They might be like, ah, yes, she was a brave opponent. I almost regret killing her. Oh well, another drink. So I think there's something there with the GIF, the idea of people who are going to fight you, but what they're not is mad about it. And there's something about the kind of like pipe-smoking, monocle, whimsy kind of feel to the GIF that reinforces that image, and I think it makes them particularly appropriate for this in a way that, say, hobgoblins are not. So there you go. That's 5 ? Ideas for what to do with the GIF. or how to insert them into another D&D campaign. Tim, I hope that you enjoyed this episode. Everyone else, if you'd like to be like Tim and get your own special episode, remember that all you've got to do is go to patreon.com/monsterman and pledge at the $5 level. In our next episode, we're continuing our journey through Creature Catalog, the 1986 supplement for Basic Dungeons & Dragons. We're also going to have a couple of special episodes, including one on early hominids. So please join me then for Monster Man, a show about monsters, because monsters are great. Thank you for listening.
If you have a favorite monster or something you'd like me to talk about, you can reach me on Twitter at GonzoHistory or by email, gonzohistory@gmail.com. To support Monster Man, just go to patreon.com/monsterman. Thank you to Ray Otis for designing the thumbnail image. Our introductory music is Solve the Damn Mystery by Jesse Spillane from the album Descent of the Goober Monster, used under a Creative Commons Attribution License. Thank you again for listening, and please join us next time.